Good afternoon. I'm James Halbach from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, and I'd like to welcome our listeners to today's Object of History Forum. The Object of History is a joint project between the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the Smithsonian's collection. For our focus today, we continue our discussion of the voting machine with Michael Malley, Associate Professor of History at George Mason University, and Larry Bird, Curator from the Division of Politics and Reform at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Welcome again, guys.
Thank you.
So last time we covered a number of interesting topics, including fraud. We talked about some constitutional issues, and so we want to continue with some of our callers' questions today. We have a question from Megan in Florida about the use of voting machines and counting ballots. Specifically, she's concerned about how the implementation of machines either sped up, how they affected the counting of ballots. Did it make it faster, or was that an issue?
Well, it seems to have become an issue with the speed with which returns could be reported. Since she's calling from Florida,
yeah,
you can probably give some specific Florida-like examples in that regard. And what sometimes happens is there will be an advance in a computer technique or technology that can be applied sort of expeditiously and with some caution, of course, to voting, counting votes. And this was the case in the 60s when a man named Joseph Harris, his invention was the Vote-O-Matic, which has since become notorious. But in its day, what that did was it was a reader into which the voter put a punch card. And this punch card was a pre-existing product, and there was a whole administrative, computer world set up to count those cards. And you just had to make it so that the voter could, systematically and correctly make the correct punches so that the machine could then read the card.
Right.
And Harris's invention sort of drove from business the then dominant gear and lever machines that were, pretty much in play then as the ultimate, form of voting and accounting the vote. And the punch card system, worked pretty well for a time, and what really, threw it for a loop in the 2000 election was the way that the particular ballot design was set up in Palm Beach County, and then the seeming inability to, sort of recompense for that for the failings of it with the very close margin of error that then resulted in having to hand count these ballots and all of the dangling punches that were created. And there's a whole vast literature about this by now. But basically, the security of it was never really in question. It's just that the margin of error sort of, every time you had to go back and recount and handle the ballots, just the physical act of looking at it, holding it up and, exposing it and looking, stacking it, moving them in stacks, that sort of thing, violated the ways that things have been punched.
Right. Go ahead.
It's dangling, and you move it across another card, you're going to knock something out that wasn't knocked out before.
The infamous dangling chance.
Right, the hanging chance.
Right, yeah.
Well, I guess maybe what Megan wants to know, though, is, for example, in, say, 1850, how long did it typically take for a precinct or for a district to know the results of a particular election, and did that change when mechanized voting or when machines started to be used? Did that allow people to know, for example, sooner who won an election?
Well, you had smaller election districts then, because it involved more people and more counting, and with the advent of machines, you could collapse many districts into one, and the reports could be tallied, you know, overnight or even that evening and reported.
Right.
And it seems to have been one of those factors that was sort of trumpeted by the people who installed these punch card systems, was that you could, you know, easily count all of the cards, the vote, the ballots with a machine reader and have the results out by 11 p.m. that night, just in time for the local news.
Right.
So it's something that we're sort of all complicit in, you know, together wanting to know, but yet we insist on total accuracy because, you know, you do have to count every vote. Every vote counts.
It takes days to count the votes in presidential elections in the 19th century. I mean, it's a long time to tabulate all the returns. Plus, the travel times for news are also slower. Even with telegraphs, they're not exactly telegraphing that information all the time. So it can take, you know, up to a week sometimes to get the results.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we have near instantaneous now, pretty much real time.
Right.
I know that there are restrictions on releasing that, of course, but essentially, when you vote on a touch screen, the system knows in real time. Go ahead.
I guess that's right, and I assume I don't know about how it reports. Never mind.
I know that there are at least reporting restrictions where, and they may just be voluntary. They may not be restrictions at all. But for example, the news.
Right.
Agreement not to,
right.
To try and minimize the impact of the news on either turnout or...
But it's not transmit. You have to go download the information from an individual terminal, as I
correct.
Understand it. Voting terminal. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, moving along, and Stan in Maryland wants to know, and here's a big question for you, how the voting machine fits into the larger narrative of voting in the 19th century. I guess there's lots of literature about how the franchise expands and contracts or whatever, and I guess Stan would like to place the voting machine in that narrative somehow. Do you have any idea how to do that?
Well, I guess it's which machine when we're talking. I'll assume for the purpose of argument, he's talking about a gear and lever machine, which would have been, you know, possible from the 1880s onward, and certainly by the turn of the century, it's on its way to becoming the so-called gold standard of electioneering and election reporting. I mean, we talked a little bit last time about the big changes that occurred. I mean, just to summarize them briefly, the system of, well, when you went to vote, typically in the 19th century, and again, we're making great generalizations here because it's different by state and even in localities and states.
Sure.
You would, say around the time of the Civil War, there are illustrations, for example, of people voting, accepting slips with candidate names on them, party slips or party tickets, and putting them into glass globe ballot boxes. And that way the system is pretty much run by the campaigns and the candidates and the parties. And the first major change that comes along just before the advent of machines, voting machines, is the introduction of the Australian ballot, which takes all of those little slips and puts them on one large blanket ballot that the voter then goes and takes and marks a la carte, even switching among, splitting tickets among parties, and then putting that into a receptacle that was typically not glass, but was, you know, a monitored box. And this was done behind a curtain. So those are really the conditions that the voting machine, you know, came about in, that inspired it and what it tried to mechanically replicate, you know, or let's say duplicate and ensure by, you know, adapting mechanical counters, levers, that sort of thing. That's just in brief.
I think it fits a little bit in with the idea of changing the notion of voting as from a privilege to a right. I mean, if you're voting in person and openly and visibly, you know, who you are matters at that moment. Everybody sees who you are. And, of course, you can use that to stop you know, to stop a black person from voting if you want, or prevent somebody who early on didn't have enough property. But it's a privilege. It's, and you're exercising a privilege. But I think the principle that starts to appear more with the voting machine is that the voters are kind of abstract, universal right. It's somebody who holds a right rather than a, and everybody of adult age or every man holds that right. It's not connected to the specific personhood of the man, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
And I think it, you know, the idea that it's going to be invisible, the idea that your vote is done in secret, that who you are in a way doesn't matter. You know, you're just a voter. Whereas the earlier system,
right,
who you are is really visible at the polling place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'd say it fits in with the changing notion of voting as, I mean, I think it's not just that they technologically can't do it early on, it's that what they're still living with is the idea that voting is a privilege that attaches to certain people.
Right.
And the modern sense is that voting is a right that adheres to all adults.
It's inherent in...
Right, it's inherent, and it doesn't matter who you are. Simply, you know, by virtue of being an adult and a citizen, you get the right to vote.
Very good. Well, I have a two-part question for you. Two people have submitted similar questions, so I'll try to connect these in a way. And both of them look forward to contemporary issues. First, Aaron in Virginia says that not everyone is happy about today's movement toward electronic voting machines, and asks whether there are parallels between current debates and 19th century arguments. And as a corollary to that, let's see, Melissa in Montana wants to know if there were any anti-technology movements or resistance to these machines on the basis of technology rather than disenfranchisement or security, some of those other issues we talked about before. So I guess, can we look towards some of the argument, let's see if we can connect contemporary sort of concerns about voting machines and historical ones.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because as they're moving in the 19th century towards voting as an abstract right, they're also, you know, very intense in the late 19th century and the 1890s, there's this movement to stop black people from voting, specifically in the South. So
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that's an anti-technology move, but it's an insistence on the part of, say, segregationists in the South that wanted to disenfranchise. And they don't do this in secret. This is openly done. There's no
sure.
hiding this. They say openly, we're going to disenfranchise the Negro. And the argument is it's the personhood matters. You know, the fact that they're black matters. In that sense, it's an anti-machine vote, because the assumption sort of behind the machines is that who you are doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
I might make that argument.
Okay.
Do I see people saying, like, is voting dehumanized by machines, and are we too dominated by machines? No, I don't see that kind of language.
Okay.
I haven't seen it. I don't really.
I mean, I wish that we had, you know, a kind of a pregnant example, you know, to roll out and say, yes, here's the parallel, but there don't really seem to be any. I mean, the objection to machine voting, you know, this only seems to come from people who were not able to benefit from it, and they would be rival politicians, you know, who were used to manipulating the vote, you know, as they understood it, stood over it and, you know, monitored it and were unable to control it, you know, henceforth. Or rival manufacturers of equipment, say, people who printed up paper ballots who now, you know, didn't have a ballot to print, lost the business, would be, you know, I mean, people who had, you know, measurable, tangible, more than an interest.
right, more
than simply an objection to a technology. One thing that had to be changed, though, before the institution of machines was some state legislatures had to go and change the language in the laws that they had written that would allow for a ballot to be not a piece of paper.
I see.
Many of them had laws, you know, stating exactly what color, what dimensions, you know, this sort of thing. And so that was done in New York, you know, to accommodate the machines that were being built in Rochester and Jamestown and other places. And it was done other places too. So that's kind of an interesting little, you know, facet of it. But
sure,
you know, objections to it, and mostly, I wouldn't say it was like welcome with open arms, but you know, there were certain expenses that had to be accounted for, and certain economies, you know, that of scale that could be, you know, had to be reworked in the size of the districts and the you know, the supervising of the policing of the returns and so forth. But
Well, I had no idea. It doesn't sound like there was any sort of Luddite argument, but I had no idea.
Well, as soon as you say that, though, someone will come up with one.
Yeah, someone will find one somewhere.
So, you know, this is how to find it out.
Well, there's always a thread of nostalgia for what people can imagine as kind of like New England democracy. You know, there's always this romanticization of the idea that, you know, you go to the town hall and you stand up and get
right.
your vote. You know,
freeholder
with
the ballot. Yeah.
So there's always a current of this. You know, this was a better America. This was simpler. You know, a man spoke his mind freely. Blah blah blah. You didn't have to hide it. So you do find that kind of thing, and it's not explicitly it doesn't say machines are bad, but especially I think in the late 19th and early 20th century, there's a lot of romanticization of the town hall.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, we have some examples of trade literature in our collection here in the museum from the Automatic Voting Machine Company of Jamestown, New York. And they're, in an effort to sell machines, the literature comes in full color, you know, photographic, you know, Life magazine-like spreads of the, you know, the quintessential, you know, upstate New York or classic New England polling place. It looks like a Norman Rockwell, you know, looks like a painting, but it's actually a photograph, and you see a short little line of people all, you know, clutching their, you know, handbags and pocketbooks, waiting to get into the machine, and, you know, there's always a town constable seated there, and there's even a puppy and a cat. You know, it's just, in other words, and then there's the machine. And the machine is trying so hard to fit into
to look nice. Yeah,
it's trying so hard, and people are generally smiling, or they have a sort of benign look on their face. And the people who are running the election seem to be, you know, pretty businesslike, and don't seem to be under any duress or pressure, which is just the opposite of what you typically see in a 19th century engraving or woodcut of counting the vote or the, you know, the people who are drunk on the courthouse steps.
Right.
And songs, you know, and raising their glasses. So it's a little world that, you know, was made, but, you know, I would say most, it was sold very easily. Sold and believed very easily.
Mm-hmm. And it does also make sense that there are little material or statutory sort of adjustments to make having to do with, no longer is there a physical
I mean, I think that's what I said. I have seen objections where people are saying it's not a ballot. You know, it's illegal. It's not a ballot. Mm-hmm. It's a machine. It's not you have to have a ballot. The law says, you know, it's like, I have seen that objection. And there's that, I can't remember where it's from. There's an illustration. It's a magazine cover of a man standing in front of a row of levers and scratching his head.
Right. Well, he's scratching his head at for whom he will vote. Scratching his head because he doesn't understand what he's supposed to do.
Right, he doesn't understand what
maybe
he's supposed
he
to do.
I don't know.
Well, he's puzzled. You know, it seems to be he's puzzled maybe by the range of choices in voting, but also by the
right.
You know, by the machine.
Right.
But I think Ryan's right. I don't see a lot of objection. In general, there's not a lot of objection. It's a pretty easy sell.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, next we have sort of a legal-type question from Vicki in D.C. about voting machines, and specifically she wonders if we take for granted that voting machines make voting less public and more private, like we talked about last time, and counting votes more accurate, it seems that you could also almost make sort of an equal protection argument that people who don't use who are not allowed to use voting machines then are not protected, or their vote is not protected the same way that someone who votes on a machine. Do you know if anybody has ever called for sort of federal standards or federal laws in order to remedy that using the sort of an equal protection argument?
It's a great question, because the problem is, as we said before, in the Constitution, voting's not really described as a federal thing. You know, it's a state issue. So it's hard to find a precedent for federal regulation. I guess the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 64 and 65, they would establish a precedent for federal election commissioners.
Sure.
But it's hard to mandate, you know, who's going to pay the cost if you're going to mandate a set of procedures.
The Equal Protection Clause is pretty interesting, and it sounds like as if the questioner may know more than they're letting on about this. That was the sort of the central premise of the Bush v. Gore,
sure,
was that the hand counting of ballots, the recount, in other words, was violated equal protection because, you know, the machines, if they were indeed inaccurate, you would have had to have a recount in every county.
Right.
In the state of Florida, and to go back and it's kind of an ingenious.
It is, yeah, it's clever.
It's kind of an ingenious sidestepping the issue of what is accurate. You know, is it more accurate than when you fed them through a reader, or then you stopped and hand counted them to look at what the intent of the voter was, which was what the issue of the hand recount was. And it's just an amazing, amazing kind of tour de force, really,
right,
of thinking, you know, in that regard. But that, the Federal Election Commission and the standards and that kind of stuff. There are federal standards for machines. I mean, they have the whole a list of things that a manufacturer needs to do to get his machine, you know, certified. But then again, it's all left up to the states. And when after the Votomatic, punch card debacle in Florida in 2000, the Help America Vote Act, which was, you know, authorized by the Congress, gave money to states to, you know, improve their voting systems. And the act did not specify what they were to do with the money. It just gave them money to do what was they assumed would be done, which would be to jettison all of these hand card, you know, punch card kinds of things and go completely electronic.
Right.
And some of them did that, and of course when they went electronic, they got rid of all of the paper. Mm-hmm. And the machines that they bought, the touchscreen systems they bought, almost without exception, with one state actually had bought a new system that had a paper printer capability attached to it. That was Nevada. That every other state in the nation bought systems that had no paper trail. and that's really, I think, what the issue is. People really don't have confidence in that. I mean, when you go to a gas station and buy gas with a credit card, or you go to an ATM, you know, you cost that little piece of paper.
Right.
Especially if you don't have much confidence in the system
that you're
participating in, you know. So.
Yeah, I'm surprised, actually, that so many municipalities voted that way, decided that way, because you do want some physical record. And I think most people do. I certainly do.
Yeah,
and so it's kind of funny, the one technology, which is sort of an optical scan technology, where you have a big ballot piece of paper that you circle in ovals, or you make little X's on it, you put some kind of mark on it, and then it's scanned right there in your presence in the precinct. But still, the ballot is a piece of paper, right?
Right.
So it's just being tabulated before your eyes in the precinct. I mean, every one of these systems has some kind of small flaw in it that you can, you know, go back. But I guess the fundamental thing, whether it's a piece of paper or it's an electronic record or if it's a lever thing, it's really the people that are in the system that are the strength of the system or its failings. I mean,
well, I think
it's the people, you know.
The question is a good one, in that you would expect, if the premise is equal, that voting is a recognition of equality of citizens, you'd expect that voting would be the same in every place. You know, that would be...
Yeah.
And that's never been the case. It's never been the case, and it was never imagined as the case from the beginning, but I think the modern expectation, it's not an unreasonable expectation, is that voting would be exactly the same process everywhere you went. Because if,
right.
if one process is better than another, then there must be inequities in voting.
Correct.
Yeah. But there's
yeah,
no...
I mean,
you have to reinvent the federal or the federal-state relations and the origins of voting in the Constitution. Probably require an amendment, I should think about that.
There's work to be done.
Yeah, sure, what it would look like. I'm trying to think about what that amendment would look like.
Well, you've actually sort of anticipated our final question here, which, again, looks forward to our current situation and about the fact that so many votes are cast, in fact, the majority of votes are cast without any sort of tangible, any tangible evidence of, there's no artifact that exists. It's on a touch screen or something like that. And that's problematic for an awful lot of people nowadays, because once the vote is cast, you, even in a recount or in an audit, you're just counting the same data again.
Right. Right.
And so, sort of in a logical sense, you're always going to come up with the same results because you're counting the same stuff. Do we know of any case, you know, prior to, I guess, maybe to 2000 where anybody has objected on the grounds of this lack of a of an artifact? Mike, you mentioned a few minutes ago that that there were people that, that argued that this isn't a, it's not a ballot, it's a,
right.
it's a machine. Do we... Do you want, would you like to elaborate on that, I guess?
Well, I don't know. You know, the most... I haven't kept up enough on the results from 2000 and 2004, except as a lot of left-wing blogger types were always pointing out, the president of Diebold, which is the major maker of electronic voter voting equipment, gave significant amounts of money to the Bush campaign and actually did more than give money, actually agitated on the crucial importance of electing George Bush. Now, that smells bad. It doesn't, I can't say anything, you know, but there's no physical record, and the guy who makes the voting machine has become an open partisan. That can't be good, and it's very difficult to find any evidence of how it might be, have been bad. You know, there isn't really, yeah, that's what I'm arguing. So I don't know if there have been challenges. I guess the challenges are based on the fact that software is easily tampered with, and easily manipulated, but I haven't. I don't have specific. Larry would know much better. I don't have specific information on specific terms.
Well, let the record show that those comments were made by Michael O'Malley.
Yeah, that's right. No,
but in the people began to write about the badness of punch card systems in the 1980s, and this was well before the Florida debacle and.
Right.
There were allegations almost every cycle about some kind of tomfoolery that was perpetrated, where the ballots were brought together to be counted. You know, typically a county or a precinct would have purchased one, you know, sizable 600-pound, you know, multi-thousand-dollar IBM card reader, and all of the ballots would have to be brought to a central location. And so the possibility for, you know, fooling and with the count were just, you know, endless. And the process, even when it was monitored, was sort of inscrutable if you didn't really know what you were looking at. And there are all kinds of allegations that someone started and stopped the machine and the machine started over, you know, all of the things weren't fed in through it, you know, this sort of thing. It's sort of been going on from, you know, time immemorial, then almost the impossible, you know, task of going back and hand, you know, collating and, you know, looking at the ballot. And it all just came, it almost came to, it just, everything they had been complaining about came true with the Vote-O-Matic, you know, typical in Palm Beach.
Right.
But there have been complaints of, you know, malfeasance, you know, for years. But again, it comes down to what people, I mean us, the electorate, and the population will accept in terms of a result. You know, with a wide margin of error, you kind of go, well, okay, you know,
right.
It doesn't matter. But when it's close, it matters greatly. I mean, it matters greatly regardless. But, you know, the ideal is that everyone counts, every vote counts, and that everyone understands and accepts the system of counting, which is the nature of a democracy.
Right. And I think what you said earlier is right. It's not like you're going to crash the system that's going to prevent all possibilities for malfeasance. I mean, they're there. They were there with the lever machine. You could just misreport the totals. I mean, it's very easy. Or you could, you know, doctor the totals after they were reported. There's all sorts of opportunities. It's not as if you're going to end it. It's not as if the machine would end it. Or any machine.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's actually all the questions that we have for this session.
Right.
So I want to thank our callers, and I want to thank our guests. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Mike. And thanks to our listeners as well. Please join us again next time.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Mike.
Bye-bye.